Today we're going to do the first half of chapter 10, which is about computing periods. That's the title of the chapter. And really what this is about is explicitly computing the period, or the integration pairing, between modular symbols and modular forms, which so I'm writing it this way. So you have modular forms, direct sum anti-holomorphic classical modular forms cross modular symbols into the complex numbers. So this is chapter 10 in the book. So the whole problem is to explicitly compute this. And first, I'll give you just a little motivation for why you might want to do this. Then I'll say something about the history of the algorithms I'll describe, and then I'll describe some algorithms. So first, motivation. If you have a new form, or suppose more generally a modular form f of weight k, then there's a conjecture of Birch and Sorrentin-Dyer generalized by Bloch and Prado to this more general setting of arbitrary weight k, and in fact, vastly more general setting than this, which explicitly identifies the values LFJ, where j goes between 1 up through k minus 1. So these are the critical integers for the L function of the form. And the conjecture is about the case of f as a new form. So I'll just write that here. And new form, by the way, means it's in the new subspace. And the reason I put a subscript here is that it's the subspace, so use a subscript to denote it. And if it were a quotient, I would put it up there. And that's a notation that Mazur introduced. So it's an element of the new subspace that's also an eigenvector for all of the Heck operators. So in the new subspace, and it's an eigenform. So TPF equals some scalar multiple. In fact, AP, the pth coefficient of F times F, because also another condition is that it's normalized. So the coefficient of Q is 1. So F equals some, well, it equals q plus sum n equals 2 to infinity a n q to the n. So that's what a new form is. A new form is a very shorthand word that refers to something that's in the new subspace that is an eigenvector for all the Heck operators and is normalized to the coefficient of q is 1. And you get automatically from that, just by checking the definition of the Heck operators in terms of q expansions, that the eigenvalues are the coefficients of the q expansion. But you might be interested in these numbers. This conjecture this conjecture about these numbers says that they're equal to the order of a group called the Shapovalov Tate group of the motive attached to F. And there's actually a whole bunch of these. I think this is the right notation. And the product of some Tamagawa numbers attached to F, divided by the order of some other group that is attached to F. I'll just say MF cubed, but I'm being pretty loose here. And you have to look at various papers to get a precise discussion of this. I think one of the best places to look is a paper I wrote with Neil Dumigan and Mark Watkins. And in that paper, we have a lot of discussion about how to go from the Bloch-Prado conjecture, which is a very general conjecture about motives. Motives are a generalization of abelian varieties, if you like, to a conjecture specifically about these special values. And it's very much in quotes and human words, kind of like the BSD conjecture, but where you have to work hard to even define most of these. But, yeah, I mean, you've thought about exactly this sort of thing a lot.
Oh, so you have a dot here.
Where? Oh, it's just in quotes, so it's wrong. I should put it down because there's a, you have to have a period here. It depends on chain.
And really, you also have a conjecture about the leading coefficient of the Taylor series about S equal to J. Though you can prove that this doesn't vanish unless J is in the middle of the critical strip. So it's exactly equal to, so the critical strip is a strip from 0 to K.
So the only possible way this can vanish is when J is equal to K over 2.
And otherwise it won't vanish. But when it doesn't vanish, it's supposed to be given by a formula like this. And various people have investigated the extent to which this might be true in various cases. This paper has a lot of specific data about the conjecture and the numbers that appear in the conjecture. And it's kind of interesting to look at. We can ask about the primes that divide these Kamigawa numbers, and Neil Dunley wrote a paper about that in the case when F has level 1. There's really a whole world out there like the Richardson-Dendari conjecture, but for any new form of any weight at any level. So that's one motivation. You're interested in these numbers because there's a big conjecture about them that generalizes the Richardson-Dendari conjecture. And to compute these, I hope you remember that I defined modular symbols E sub, okay, I underline them, E sub k, modular symbol in MK gamma with the property that if you pair F with EJ, you just get L F J. So if you can compute the pairing, you can compute the special values. And from a theoretical point of view, you can you can define a number omega sub j, which I kind of hinted at here, and prove that this pairing divided by that omega j, you can prove that it's an algebraic integer. And another thing you can even prove is, well, you can give a, if you replace f by the product of the Galois conjugates of f, should be j, you divide by appropriate period there, defined in a similar way to the period in the BSD conjecture. There's an explicit formula for this purely in terms of modular symbols. Numbers. It's the index of one lattice and another. This is something that's in my thesis. And that I proved with the Mudig object. This basically gives you a nice rationality result plus an algorithm to compute some rational number purely algebraically. And the complexity of computing is it all goes into computing these objects. These objects, the actual computation really boils down to computing a Hermite normal form quickly. That's really what's the limiting factor of computing this. So, from the point of view of, well, studying this LFJ, it's certainly good to understand this period mapping. So that's one situation in which understanding period mapping is relevant. And just as a quick aside, just pointing out that the theory of modular symbols can help you get interesting statements about rationality of the special value divided by an omega. Notice that here you have a bunch of rational numbers, and then you have this transcendental number. If you divide by that, you're supposed to get these, well, really have to take product of these, but basically it's rationality, something that's consistent with the Bloch-Kotto conjecture. Okay, so that's one motivation, computing special values of L functions. Here's a second, entirely different motivation. So this was motivation one. Now motivation two, explicitly computing Abelian properties. So an abelian variety is a generalization of an elliptic curve, and It's an observation of Shimura that goes back to, I think, 1955. But if you have a new form F, just as before, in SK gamma,
a new form,
then you can associate to it, and K has to be bigger than or equal to 2 here. You can associate to F an abelian variety A sub F. This is an abelian variety. It's defined only over C of the complex numbers in general. So for algebraic geometry people, if you don't know, an abelian variety is simply an algebraic variety that is projective and is equipped with a group structure. And it's a theorem that such a thing automatically has to have an abelian group structure. The structure must be abelian. That's a definition of abelian variety. And over the complex numbers, there's a uniformization theorem similar to what you have with the Weierstrass P function and elliptic curves, but for general dimensions, any abelian variety over the complex numbers you can represent as a complex vector space V modulo a lattice lambda. Now, a lattice here, if V is dimension G, then a lattice is a free Z module of rank 2G, so that if you take the R span of it, you get V. That's the definition of lattice. And what we have here is that the complex points of this abelian variety, they must be at this form. Any abelian variety over C, it is just a vector space modulo lattice over the complex numbers. But not conversely, you can, in dimension 1, if you give me any lattice in the complex numbers, in that one-dimensional complex vector space, then there is a corresponding elliptic curve whose complex points correspond to the points of C modulo lattice. And you get that from the Weierstrass P function. If you have a lattice, you write down the Weierstrass P function in the lattice, and that explicitly gives you an elliptic curve with complex points of C modulo of the lattice. But interestingly, when the dimension is bigger than 1, if you write down a random lattice, it's not at all likely that there will be an abelian variety of these complex points are the points in V modulo lambda. So it does happen sometimes. And the way you can detect it is whether or not there's what's called a non-degenerate Riemann form on V, which is a certain type of bilinear pairing on V that restricts to be integer valued on lambda and has certain properties. So you can alternatively think of an abelian variety over C as a complex vector space, a lattice in there, and additionally a non-degenerate Riemann form. If you have all of that structured, then you can construct, I think using theta functions, an algebraic variety whose complex points are V mod lambda.
I just gave you a quick 5-minute course in abelian varieties over C. There's a very nice article by Rosen in the Cornell Silverman volume that's devoted to Faltin's proof of Mordell's conjecture about abelian varieties over C. So that's really a very good reference from Rosen. I think the title is just abelian varieties over C. So, by the way, though, in the special case of k equals 2, in fact, this abelian variety has a canonical structure of abelian variety defined over q. So it has, that's really nice, because then you can consider it from the point of view of number theory. In the case of k greater than 2, it's an abelian variety, but it's definitely, in some cases it could be defined over Q, but usually it's defined only over some big field, over a transcendental extension of Q. And I think it can alternatively, one other thing about it is its dimension is equal to the degree of the field generated by the Fourier coefficients, A sub n, of your modular form over Q. For example, if F has rational integer Fourier coefficients, if it has rational integer Fourier coefficients, then you get an abelian variety of dimension 1. That is an elliptic curve. So, for example, if you consider the function
the delta function, that's a modular form of level 1 and weight 12, has integer coefficients, and there is an elliptic curve associated to it. Interestingly enough. Just this elliptic curve is some transcendental probability chain variance that you can compute to whatever precision you want using explicit computation of this period mapping. But what is it? I don't know. The only time that you can really recognize, as far as I can tell, practice the chain variant of the elliptic curve you get via this matter is when f is a CM form, a new form for which half of the Fourier coefficients are zero. That's an equivalent definition. Then you can recognize the elliptic curve. It's isomorphic to some CM elliptic curve, so it's defined over a number field. But for some reason people don't consider this abelian variety very often unless k is equal to 2. And really, when k is greater than 2, it's much more sensible in sort of modern lingo to consider the emotive nymphs of f attached to f called the Grothendieck emotive of f. And there's a really nice paper of Tony Scholl that's all about constructing a motive attached to f. And by the way, the other thing is good to show more variety. This is a more modern way to go. So a Grothendieck motive, by the way, what you do is you take a variety and a projector onto, let's see, how to, kind of complicated to define, but basically you take a variety and a certain type of morphism, and given that data, you can then systematically, for any cohomology theory at all, cut out a piece of the cohomology of the variety. And the motive is, you can think of it as basically being the functor that attaches to whatever thing you're considering the cohomology for, that piece of the cohomology of your variety given by the projector. So, I mean, it's hard to define a motive right off, but it's basically something that has cohomology groups associated to it in a very functorial way. But that's really far aside. I don't mention any of this in the book, for example. So, what does computing abelian varieties have to do with the period mapping, since it's supposed to be motivation too? The answer is that, well, I haven't defined this, but I will define it for you. And it's not at all hard to define. I'll tell you what A sub f is. So here's what A sub f is. You fix your f, and S k gamma. And you consider its Galois conjugates. The coefficients A sub n here, they're all algebraic numbers, and they're defined over some finite extension of Q. So you consider the Galois conjugates of those numbers. What I mean by that is the Galois. Since all the coefficients lie in one single fixed finite algebraic extension of Q, the Galois group of Q bar over Q acts on this. Power series dot property. So if you take any element sigma, any automorphism, for example, complex conjugation or something, then you can apply it to all the coefficients. You get another Q expansion, and that's what I mean by one of the Galois conjugates of F. So you just list all of them. So maybe the first one is a complex conjugate of it, for example. Right? You list all of them. Let's just call them F1 through FD. So this is just an example. So you list all the Galois conjugates. And I'm going to construct for you a lattice lambda in a very canonical way inside of a complex vector space. And the quotient of the complex vector space by that lattice is the abelian variety A sub f attached to f. And in the case when k is 2, that's an abelian variety that has a natural structure defined over q. For example, when f is of weight 2 and has rational coefficients, what you get is an elliptic curve. And if you run over all f for a given group gamma, say gamma 0 of n, you'll actually run through all elliptic curves of isogeny of conductor n. That's a theorem of a lot of people. Okay, so here's the construction of A sub f. So I need to give you a complex vector space and a lattice. And I will have defined A sub f. And this is again due to Shimura.
So he didn't use modular symbols, but he used some
group cohomology that is essentially equivalent to modular symbols. So here's the construction. Actually, I guess, as far as I know, I'm the only one that ever defines A sub f using modular symbols. So maybe, but anyways, I've never seen it defined. But it's certainly equivalent to Shimura does. So here's what you do. We have MK gamma, and we have a pairing between MK gamma and cusforms. So what you can do is map MK gamma to the following vector space V, which is on, W, comma, C. And here W is the span of this. Span of these over C. So I'm defining W that way. So W again equals the span over C of F1 through FD. Okay? So that's just the span of the Galois conjugates of F as a complex vector space. So when D equals 1, it's just the span of F. So here's what the homomorphism is. Given a modular symbol, actually I'm going to put S here instead. Restrict to. Given a modular symbol X, just map it to the map, which sends a modular form F to pair F with X. And that's it. So the image of this is, well, this is a free abelian group, right? We generated a free abelian group. And you can show that the image in here is a lattice. This is a lattice. And you get that with a little bit of work. And moreover, there's a non-degenerate Riemann form on V. You get that from the Petersen inner product on cuspidal modular forms. And that's described explicitly in Shimura's paper. So A sub f, well, it's just a co-kernel of this map. It's just complex things. So that defines the abelian variety A sub f. So for any new form, you have an abelian variety like this. And in the case of weight 2, this is a construction that allows you to systematically go from weight 2 modular forms to, well, here I only showed you how to do this over C, but with some additional work, you can do it over Q when the weight is 2. So given any new form of weight 2, you get an associated abelian variety. The dimension of the abelian variety is the degree of the field generated by the Fourier coefficients. So if you think back, for example, to Wednesday, I showed you on my computer an example of a modular form where the Fourier coefficients lived in a number field of degree 20. There's associated to that specific modular form a 20-dimensional abelian variety. And an interesting thing that you can try to do is compute as much as you possibly can about that abelian variety without ever writing down any explicit equations for the abelian variety. I mean, it's a variety, so you could give it by giving hundreds of equations that cut it out in some massive projective space. In theory, that's possible. But without doing any of that, but just using the fact there is an abelian variety out there, and it's well-defined via a construction like this, you can compute a huge amount of different things about the abelian variety attached to that modular form. That's really the whole point of my thesis, for example, is just ways of computing as much as you can about an abelian variety attached to a modular form without actually writing down the abelian variety. You look like you want to ask a question. So please do.
I'm trying to understand why we put on the backboard.
Yes, sorry. It's an exact sequence, except I'm not injective here. And I just If you take the image of SK gamma, and you take V, you take it inside of V and question out, you get an abelian variety.
And V is a homomorphism.
Yeah, it's a complex vector space of dimension D, and it's just all C-linear maps from the span of the Galois conjugates of F to the complex numbers. So non-canonically, it's just the same as W, if you choose a basis. Typically, people might identify this as C to the D and choose it by choosing a basis and so on, but it's non-canonically. So we will stop you from doing that. Yeah.
F is in W.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, F is in W.
So not the original one.
Oh, you're right. That's really bad. Let me pause. Thank you. I mean, it would, in fact, take F to that, but... No, it wouldn't, because it's totally different. This is in a modular form. Maybe I'll call it phi. This is supposed to... it is modular form. G is exactly my notation. Yeah. It's supposed to take specific elements G that are in W. W is a subspace of S in the gamma, so... G is a very good notation for the elements of W.
So the reason you actually take W is for it to end up...
If you just, you mean as opposed to just taking a span of F?
Yeah.
One-dimensional space? Yeah, if you took the span of F, you would get an image that's not a lattice. It would have too big of rank inside of there. I think it would still have rank 2G, where G is the number, or 2D. Right. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure it would still have rank 2D. So you wouldn't get an elliptic curve at all. You just get something that's not a lattice proportion. The electric curve. So, or let me think about that for a second. Yeah, you just don't get a lattice. So you get all these ones that they just.
And can you tell if you have an abelian variety if you can get it this way?
Yes. There's a beautiful conjecture that tells you which abelian varieties of a Q should arise from this construction. And it's due to Ribbit. And the first case is elliptic curves over Q all arise via this construction up to isogeny. And that's a theorem of Wallace, Ray Conrad Diamond Taylor. It's what he proved in order to prove Fermat's last theorem. But what about the generalization of that? What about if you have a two-dimensional abelian variety, let's fix things and make the statement a little simpler. If you have a two-dimensional simple abelian variety, does it or does it not come via construction like this? And these abelian varieties over Q, in the case of dimension one, they're not so special. They're just all elliptic curves. But in the case of any bigger dimension, they're actually very special. And here's why. The Hecke operators act on F, and hence they act on W, because F is an eigenvector for the Hecke operators. And the fact that Hecke operators act on W means they act on this dual in a natural way. And also, the fact that Hecke operators act on here, and the fact that, as we did in a homework problem, I think, that was in the notes that I didn't go over, the fact that the pairing is Hecke equivariant, it respects the Hecke operators, means that AF is equipped with an action of the Hecke operators. More precisely, what you get is that the endomorphism ring of the complex abelian variety A sub F contains inside of it, T modulo the kernel of the map from T to the endomorphism ring of A sub F. And that kernel, this quotient is exactly the same thing. Canonically, it's the same thing as Z adjoining the Fourier coefficients of your new form. So, inside of the endomorphism ring of your abelian variety, you have this huge endomorphism ring. It's not really surprisingly huge in the case of degree 1. When D equals 1, all it says is that Z is in the endomorphism ring. But when D is bigger than 1, you have a very special thing. Your abelian variety has a large endomorphism ring. So, Ribbit codified, given a definition that doesn't have anything to do with modular forms, of an abelian variety having a large endomorphism ring. He called that being of GL2 type, and then he conjectured that any abelian variety of GL2 type is modular, so up to isogeny arises via this construction. And it's a conjecture you should believe. It's almost a theorem, actually. So first, it's a conjecture you should believe because
we're going to write something important.
Conjecture with it. Every abelian variety A over Q of GL2 type. By the way, for a simple abelian variety, GL2 type simply means that if you take the endomorphism ring tensored with Q, it's a number field of degree equal to the dimension of A. It's very simple for simple abelian varieties. It's a little bit more complicated to define for non-simple ones, but for the purposes of this conjecture, something comes from A sub F's. It's modular if and only if each of its simple pieces are. So GL2 type just means i.e. The endomorphism ring of A tensored with Q is equal to a number field of degree equal to the dimension of A. So for an elliptic curve, that's
already, I mean, that's just for an elliptic curve, that's automatic.
This endomorphism ring can't be any bigger than Q, so these are the endomorphisms defined over Q. It's a good exercise to prove that for an elliptic curve, the endomorphism ring over Q is just Z. Even for a CM curve, the CM endomorphisms are never defined over Q. You always have to go up to a bigger extension. So this is what GL2 type means, and the conjectures are modular, i.e. they arise from this construction. Modular, i.e. they're isogenous to an A sub F. And you should believe this because it's a consequence of Serre's conjecture. So, which is something I mentioned right at the beginning of the course. Serre's conjecture says if you have any odd, irreducible, two-dimensional mod P representation of the Galois group of Q bar over Q, then it arises from a modular field. And Ribbit proves, and it's not really that hard to read this proof if you have, say, spent 5 years in grad school studying modular forms. That is to say, I read the proof and understood it. But Serre's conjecture implies that this is true. And Serre's conjecture is rumored to almost be a theorem these days. So it's not quite, but this is, quote, almost proved. And it is proved in a lot of cases. Already. So once this is proved, then this will be proved, and we'll know exactly which abelian varieties over Q arise via this construction. And of course, you'll know there's a lot of abelian varieties that are not of this form. And there are other similar approaches to defining modularity for those that involve different types of constructions, modular forms for different groups besides SL2Z and subgroups of SL2Z, and so on. I mean, that works somewhat preliminary, but for example, I saw Wiles give a talk at a conference on the BST conjecture they organized in Think and IAS, and it was about two-dimensional abelian varieties that are not of GL2 type. How can you parameterize them in a natural way analogous to this? I think he, if I remember correctly, had some conjectural construction involving a different type of modular formings. Well, I don't want to say anything, so I don't want to be wrong.
Is K equal to 2?
Yes, absolutely.
This is ice. This is defined over Q. And this is an S2 gamma 1 of F.
Why?
So that's Ribbit's conjecture, which is very believable. By the way, you can define modular forms for lots of different groups, not just SL2Z. You can define for SL3, SL4, and you know, there's still whole families of linear groups which you can define modular forms, and there are analogs and modular symbols for a lot of these. And you'll notice that I've completely omitted any discussion about them from this course. And there's this guy, Paul Guttels, who has written an appendix that's 60 pages long for my book, and it's exactly on computing with higher rank groups, so modular forms attached to higher rank groups. It's not in there yet, but if you go to the website for the course, then I just posted a link to the appendix.
Higher rank groups. That's generalizations of modular forms to groups other than SL2Z and its subgroups. Okay, so now I've given you tons of motivation for considering the period map. And by the way, this map is called the period map. It goes from modular symbols to this vector space, and this lattice is called the lattice of periods. This is a lattice, it's the lattice of periods. Quote, periods. And I think a motivation for calling them periods is that if you think all the way back to the Weierstrass-P function, that lattice, those are the periods of the Weierstrass-P function as a complex analytic function. So, and likewise, in this more general setting, there are functions who have elements of this lattice as their periods that define an explicit isomorphism between V modulo lambda and an abelian variety embedded in some projective space. Okay, so in the remaining few minutes, after having spent all this time motivating consideration of the period mapping, I'll say something about how you can actually compute it. And the algorithms that I describe in here, which I'll barely be able to say anything about in the time that I have, where they come from is as follows. So I really wanted to compute the period mapping in order to basically have, well, first I just wanted a complete package in Magma when I was implementing modular form stuff for Magma. And I thought it would be nice to generalize, say I knew all these definitions, but I didn't know what you actually got. What is the J invariant of the elliptic curve attached to delta? It'd be nice to know. So Cremona talks about, in great detail in this book, how to compute the period mapping in a special case when F has weight 2 and the group is gamma 0 of N. And interestingly, he has some algorithms in there and calculations that just don't work. They only work in the case of weight 2, gamma 0 of N. There's various things that cancel out in that case that don't cancel out in any other cases. So it was kind of annoying, and I couldn't find anywhere else that discussed how to explicitly and efficiently compute the map. So Helena Verl and I came up with a pretty good theory for computing this map, or more precisely this integration pairing for higher weight and groups besides gamma zero. And it just generalizes what Cremona does, but you have to keep track of certain error terms. So that's what's basically summarized and described in chapter 10. It's the generalization to higher weight and general group. So, a few things to tell you. So everything else I'll say today is simply about the problem of given a modular form F and a modular symbol X, how do you compute the pairing of F with X efficiently? Actually, I lied slightly. I'll talk about how do you compute it at all. It's not at all obvious that you can compute it at all. And unless you can compute it at all, there are various tricks that allow you to do it more efficiently. Okay, so the first notion that's useful to introduce is the following. So modular symbols, you'll recall, are paths between cusps tensored with homogeneous polynomials of degree k minus 2. So why restrict to paths between cusps? Why not just allow paths between anything in the upper half plane, in the extended upper half plane? That's what mk bar gamma is. So this is defined just as before, but the alpha and betas when you have alpha and betas here, you allow the alpha and beta to be any elements of h star at all. So you don't require that they be cusps. So, for example, if this is the complex upper half plane, then this would be a perfectly good element of mk bar gamma and all these extended modular symbols. And there's a natural map from the usual modular symbols into the extended ones, because if you have a usual modular symbol, it's just given as a formal sum of homogeneous polynomials times these alpha betas, and where it's just a restriction on the alpha betas that they be elements of P1 of Q. So
Here, it's just the same, it's like the same group, but you define it in such a way that you've removed one of the restrictions in the definition. So you have a natural map like this. But the crucial thing is the following. Well, here you have a modular symbol and a modular form. And the modular symbol looks something like this. Some formal linear combination of some number of paths, maybe go up to plane infinity at some point, and you have some path like this, maybe something like that. It's some formal linear combination of these things. And of course you can break it up and reduce to just computing for one of the things in the formal linear combination. But the annoying thing is that if you simply try to reverse the order of integration and summation in the definition of the period, or the definition of the integration period, you end up getting a whole bunch of things that don't converge, because you end up with e to the 2 pi I times some alpha that's a rational number appearing in the formulas. Actually, end up with e to the 2 pi alpha n appearing in the formula, and I think when maybe it's a minus sign, e to the minus 2 pi alpha n. We'll see in a minute. But you end up with something like this in the formula. When alpha is a rational number, you just don't get good convergence, or any convergence at all. It diverges. You get these sums that just diverge. So you can't just directly use the definition and switch the order of integration and summation. But what you can do is the following. So this group, every element in this group is some sum of paths between cusps. That's really annoying. But in this group, you have this thing might be equivalent to a path that looks like this. It's possible. It could be equivalent. Maybe these are equivalent in this group. And in this group, you have the same relations as before. So when two things are equivalent, the integral of f against those two things is the same. You're just transferring the path in such a way that you don't change the integral at all. And here, the integral will converge because you get away from the x-axis. So the whole trick of the whole theory for computing this pairing explicitly in the weight 2 case and more general is to embed normal modular symbols and extended modular symbols, and then use relations in the extended modular symbols to move your path away from the x-axis. Once you've done that, then you switch the order of integration and summation, you explicitly work out what all the integrals are, and then you get an infinite sum that converges. So that's kind of the one sentence description of everything in this chapter. And I think the only time, the right thing to do now is to simply explicitly compute this and show you that you really have to do something to move away. And then there are a whole bunch of explicit formulas you write down, all kinds of. There's actually a pretty deep theorem proof that proves that you can always move away in an appropriate sense. But I'll go on that proof. So I'm going to do one calculation, which is just kind of a calculus exercise, and that will be the end of this. By the way, what I'm going to do next time on Monday is talk about this in more detail in a special case when f is in S2 gamma 0, then it has rational coefficients. I'll talk about Cremona's program to compute all the elliptic curves over Q of a given conductor, and I'll talk about some other approaches to the same problem that I hope to carry out possibly at the MSRI summer workshop for finding all elliptic curves of a given conductor. That's what's coming up next. So I'm just going to finish class by doing one explicit calculation. So consider f paired with this modular symbol, x to the m, y to the k, minus q minus m, and just the fixed ID is alpha to infinity. Okay, and here let's view f as sum a n q to the m, and it's an element of s k gamma. And it need not be an eigenform at this point. So if you work this out, this is, by definition first, the integral from alpha to infinity of f of z, z to the m, dz. That's the definition. Now, you can reverse the order of integration and summation at least, if the alpha is strictly in the upper half plane, then you can't, because the series here converges absolutely. It's, after all, it's just the power series
of a holomorphic function on the unit disk. And it's a basic theorem for complex analysis that such things converge very nicely, a radius of convergence. So I'll do this, and you'll see that if alpha is really in the upper half plane, then you're in good shape. But if alpha were in P1 of Q, then this just wouldn't work. Okay? So all I'm going to do is take this, and this should remind you of a calculation I did the other day when I was explicitly computing the special value of an null function. So all I'm doing is switching the order of integration and summation. Okay, so all I've done here is taken, well, f is equal to sum a n e to the 2 pi I z n, and I switch the order of integration and summation, justified because that's the power series of a holomorphic function on the unit disk in terms of Q. But only really makes sense when alpha is in the upper half. Now, you can completely explicitly evaluate this integral. One way is repeated integration by parts, another way is to do a change of variables. As James pointed out, you do a change of variables and you see that you get the same formula as defines the gamma function. And explicitly, here's what you get. And it's kind of big, but you get sum n equals 1 to infinity and an. And here we have this whole integral becomes e to the 2 pi I n alpha sum s equals 0 to m minus 1 to the s alpha to the m minus s divided by 2 pi I n to the s plus 1 times the product. It looks like the gamma function j equals m plus 1 minus s mj. Did anything I just said make sense? I was just formally writing. So let's see. S is an integer here. Remember, this whole thing is just a specific it's an integral. So this is something that looks pretty factorial-like. This is just this finite sum that involves 2 pi I and the alpha in the upper half plane, and then you have this coefficient e to the 2 pi I n alpha. So if alpha is in the upper half plane, imagine it being, for example, I, and right here you have e to the minus 2 pi n, and as n goes to infinity, this gets really, really small. This isn't very big, so you end up getting a convergence series. But what if alpha were, say, on the x-axis, for example, alpha equals 0, then these are all 1. These can be, alpha equals 0. One here is, maybe alpha equals 0, it's funny in this formula, but maybe take alpha equal to 1. So you get e to the 2 pi I n, which always has absolute value 1. That's not so good. And here you have this big factorial thing. So it's really, you don't get a convergence if there were any, it's horrible. So, you really have to, in order to compute period integrals, you can't just directly use this with alpha equal to a rational number. You have to do some procedure where you move from a path like this to a path entirely in the upper half plane. Okay, you see how you have to do that. But you can do that. And I think it's a very general technique in computing integrals against functions. You change variables to get something that converges way better, and then you evaluate that numerically. So that's all I really want to show you about computing integration pairing. There's a lot of other stuff in the chapter, but I guess that's the key thing. One other thing is proposition, 10.4.2 sort of explains how to transform from,
there's maybe a really useful picture is the following. So here's an example of a path that you might integrate from 0 to infinity. So you might want to integrate from the path from 0 to infinity. And there you'd have
It would be just like this, except alpha is 0.
So that's not so good.
Just one second. But what if you could find some automorphism that switches 0 and infinity and leaves, say, I over squared of n fixed? Then you could use it via some clever work. You can use it to, along with the modular symbols relations, you just write this path as a path from I over root n to infinity plus the path from 0 to I over root n. You apply that automorphism to both, well, to this path only, just this chunk of the path. That transforms it to a path from I over root n to infinity. Also, they change the sign.
Damn it, didn't try.
So it transforms the path, possibly changing the sign. And then you end up with this path plus the multiple of that path. And that's way easier to deal with. That's actually how you efficiently compute L of E1 for an elliptic curve, using that sort of observation. In other words, the path from 0 to infinity is equal to the path from I over root n, where n is the conductor of the curve, to infinity, plus another path from I over root n, possibly with the sign to infinity.
And then there's some transformation. But basically, you can break up stuff like this.
Maybe you can break the path right here, do some automorphism that gives you paths like that, et cetera, et cetera.
And you can formalize this all really nicely and program a computer, et cetera. Okay, so I'm now done. And there are only, I guess, two more lectures. It's Monday's a holiday, so Wednesday I will tell you about computing all elliptic curves of a given conductor. And then the last day of class, Friday, I'll talk about how to get Z-module generators for the Heck algebra. So that's the theorem of Sturm that I'll explain to you. Okay? So have a good long weekend.